The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
Good morning. Welcome to the Korea Society and welcome to Studio Korea. We're delighted to have you here in the studio audience today, and we'd like to welcome all of our online viewers. We know we have viewers today in Washington, Seoul, and elsewhere, so welcome to them. I would like to welcome our distinguished guests who are here today to discuss the complexities, the opportunities, the challenges of relations among Korea, China, and the United States. And I will begin here directly to my left with Professor Shen-Dung Lee, who is Associate Dean from Fudan University in Shanghai, China, who has flown in for this. Thank you very much, Dung Lee. Scott Snyder, our good friend from the Council on Foreign Relations, Professor Sung-Yun Lee, who is here from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Ralph Kossa, the president of the Pacific Forum Center for Strategic and International Studies in Honolulu, and who has actually flown in from Burma for this. Thank you, Ralph. John DeLory, who is a professor at Yonsei University and author of Wealth and Power, which was mentioned here at the Korea Society and around town earlier this year, a very excellent publication indeed. And I'd like to welcome Han Suk-hee, who is here from Yonsei University, and as we will get to shortly, played a role in terms of advising President Park Geun-hye and was with the group that visited Beijing this summer. I also wanted to take a few moments by way of introduction and recognize a few people in our studio audience who have played a very key role in getting us all here today. We'd like to thank all of our friends from the National Committee on American Foreign Policy who have joined us. They are led by Don Zagoria here in the front row, and we are delighted that Don and his team have been kind enough to extend an invitation to their group. I'd also like to thank our friends from the Consulate and Mission and to recognize Carter Booth, one of our board members here at the Korea Society. A special thanks as well to the Korea Society staff, many of whom have put in very extensive efforts in recent days to see this morning come to fruition. I would also like to say by way of introduction that this morning is something of a tribute by way of recognition of the memory of Professor Robert Scalapino. This is the first of what we hope will be a regular occasional series of discussions of regional relations named in honor of Bob. All of those here at the table knew Professor Scalapino very well. We would like to thank Rochelle Halperin at the University of California, Berkeley, as well as Lynn Scalapino and the entire family for extending Bob's name for us to this. He was certainly an intellectual force. He was a very dramatic mind and a very passionate force for Northeast Asia and the improvement of relations. And we're delighted to be able to recognize him in even the small way through this morning's conversation. We'd also like to begin with sort of full knowledge of the fact that we're on the top of a very busy media cycle. Many of the individuals here you may have seen quoted just in the last few hours in major publications and in electronic media in terms of the reported execution of Jang Sung-taek in North Korea, the consolidation of power by Kim Jong-un, or perhaps a power struggle involving Kim Jong-un. And we would like to take about 15 minutes at the beginning here before we launch into the discussion more fully on the trilateral relation dynamic to discuss really the top of the news today and to get a reaction in terms of the execution of Jang Sung-taek as it's reported and what may or may not be happening in Pyongyang. And perhaps I could actually begin at the opposite side and ask Han Suk-hee to begin, and we'll just go around and ask if you've any thoughts about what's happening in Pyongyang now and what would inform our audience here in New York and online.
Maybe. I don't have enough information about the execution of Jang Sung-taek, but from my observation, I think I can find three implications of the execution of Jang Sung-taek. The first one is still North Korean politics is still remained in 1950s and 1960s of confrontations. So if the major leader, he if you know to enforce his own power, he has to use some violence against his opponents. Second thing is uncertainty of the future of North Korean politics would be very increased. So currently, many people say that why Kim Jong-un, he just initiated execution because of his lack of his power or the strength of his power. A lot of rumors there, but I think this kind of scenario gives us some implication that the uncertainty of the future of North Korean politics would be much more growing. Third one is the North Korea and China relationship is very uncertain. Currently, I think China wants to have a more influence over North Korea, but this instance showed us that China's influence over North Korea is very limited. So the future of North Korea-China relationship would be very uncertain. So I just summarized that with these three factors.
Thank you, Professor Han. Professor DeLore.
Yeah, there's so many different directions we can take the Jang Song-taek discussion in, but you know, the sorts of things that I'm thinking about, first of all, I'm trying to, rather than, as someone who didn't anticipate this, you know, some people did, but I was not of that group, it's a good chance to really question your assumptions and think about what are the questions. Like Suki is saying, there's so many question marks still. So I think sharpening the questions we ask and the things we're looking at, looking for in the future is important. But one question I'm asking is, why did North Korea make the decision to give so much detail about this, to make it so public? I think most of us would agree that's unprecedented, certainly in recent memory. It's a kind of airing of dirty laundry. And it's someone who, it's not solely Jang Song-taek. It's explicit that there's a faction. They're naming more and more names. Plus the reports we're getting of other people are having trouble. So this is not just one bad apple. This is a whole group at the very highest levels of their system. And this is a system that, you know, from the outside world, we see it as, for the most part, as sometimes we describe it as an evil system itself, a regime, but from within the regime, it's the exact mirror opposite. They pride themselves on their unity, on their virtue, and yet here they're so in such detail admitting the level of corruption and vice and division. That this is really, you know, my background is in China, modern China, like Suki, and, you know, I'm thinking about it in terms of, many of us who watch China are thinking about it in terms of Bo Xilai and the trial of Bo Xilai, but it also sort of goes back to Lin Biao, you know, in the height of the Cultural Revolution, where the person who was leading the cult of Mao suddenly turned into the enemy of the revolution. And we know in retrospect that that was a whiplash moment for the Chinese people because they were being prodded on to believe in all these things, and suddenly the leader of that movement turned out to be a counter-revolutionary. So so those are some of the things. The other quickly questions I'm asking is, you know, what is the fallout with China? As Suki is saying, I mean, and I'd love to hear Shen Dingli and others who spend time in China get into this. You know, in my experience talking with Korea experts in China, yes, Jang Song-taek had a big part of that portfolio, but they didn't necessarily have this deep love for Jang Song-taek. And they're very pragmatic, too, especially when it comes to the economic side of the relationship, which he was key to. So for the time being, I don't see this as a signal that there's going to be necessarily a very bad period between China and North Korea. It hasn't been a particularly good period in the last year or two when Jang has had a big part of that portfolio. So I think this is a real moment of truth for Kim Jong-un, or whoever ordered this and whoever is really in charge. They have some major decisions to make about how they're going to handle the relationship with China going forward. And similarly with the economic reform, Jang, you know, we often say Jang equals China, Jang equals economic reform. Therefore, if Jang is down, it's anti-China and it's anti-economic reform. I'm also not seeing it yet being framed by the North Koreans in terms of the target of this is economic reform. And just one point I would make To fill that out a little bit, is there have been these strange, you know, it seems like these statements against Zhang have gone out of their way to say he tried to disrupt the authority of the cabinet. And the cabinet has been given this lead position in economic reformist efforts such as they are. So now Zhang, I also, you know, saw in this most recent statement, was blamed for the 2009 currency redenomination. You know, so rather than try and defend that choice, they're actually laying it on him. So whether it's true or not, so far I'm not seeing the linkages to that broader point. But again, it's right now just raising the deepest questions about what's going on in North Korea and how do we evaluate it.
Thank you, John DeLore. Ralph Cawson.
Yeah, Steve, thank you. I mean, first and foremost, when it comes to North Korea, we're all guessing. What you have here are some very accomplished guessers, but we're all guessing, and certainly this is a very confusing time, and we'd have to wait for a few more shoes to drop, a few more people to be disposed in order to figure out, and clearly I think more people will be disposed, as John says. The frustrating part from a person who's tried to figure out what North Korea is up to is that every event has at least two equally plausible, diametrically opposed answers. You can see what's going on right now and conclude, as many seem to be concluding in the press, this shows Kim Jong-un is firmly in control. He's now got the power and he's, you know, even throw out his uncle. But you could make the equal case that this means that he's not in control at all, that the military is essentially calling the shots. They're keeping him there as a figurehead, and they're removing the, quote, civilian general, who obviously they weren't real pleased with in the first place. What's the real answer? Who knows? You know, we're all sort of guessing, speculating, trying to watch and see. As John says, and I tend to agree with him, but with probably a little bit more skepticism, many people had been hoping for a regime change in North Korea. We may have just had it, but not in the way we wanted. And this is, I think, a concern. I was sort of looking to Korea to hopefully someday follow the China model. And recall, we had regime change in China. One day, the Gang of Four were in charge. Mm-hmm. The next day, Deng Xiaoping came back, the reformist. A lot of people were looking at John Sung-taek as the Deng Xiaoping of North Korea. This was the guy that was going to sort of turn things around. I think China in particular was looking at him in that regard. Mm. What I keep hearing from the Chinese up until the last few days on North Korea is give them a chance. They're moving in the right direction. They're really serious about reform, et cetera, et cetera. I would imagine there are a lot of people in China right now doing a lot of serious reassessing and trying to figure out just what's really going on. It could mean that any hope for reform in the near term is now gone. On the other hand, it could have just been a power struggle between a couple of people that had nothing to do with policy, it had all to do with power, and John Sung-taek lost out. So we're going to have to see, you know, a little bit more happen before I think we can take a good guess. But I would really expect that the country that is most concerned right now is China, since it seemed to me, at least, that they had put a lot of eggs in the John Sung-taek basket, and that basket is now overturned.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Professor Lee.
Thank you, Dr. Noper. I think this event, the humiliating fall of Chang Sung-taek and the swift execution of this number two man in North Korea may come to be viewed years from now as a harbinger of the decline and gradual fall of the DPRK, but not in a conventional way, that is. In the 18th century, Edward Gibbon, upon the completion of his magisterial, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, intoned thus, "I will not dissemble the first emotion of joy, and perhaps the establishment of my fame upon the recovery of my freedom. But my pride was soon humbled, and a sober melancholy was cast over my mind at the thought that I had taken an everlasting leave of an old and agreeable companion, and whatever the future date of my history, the life of the historian must be short and precarious." To steal a line from that lengthy passage, in a totalitarian system, oftentimes we've seen that the life of the number two man is short and precarious. 60 years ago, Stalin died on March 5th. At the time, a man named Beria was widely considered to be the most powerful man living at the time. Well, 3 months later, he joined Stalin. And as Professor Delury mentioned, Lin Biao as well. In China, we see purges of the number two man, while the number one man, the man on top, is still in power. So Chiang Song-taek's case should not be viewed as that unconventional. It should not come as a surprise, because his utility as the guardian or regent was to expire. What may be surprising to some is that it came so soon, just 2 years into Kim Jong-un's rule. Now, we can extrapolate from this, as Mr. Costa said, two opposing views, whether this is an indication of the fact that Kim Jong-un is firmly in charge, or whether this indicates that there's some regime instability situation brewing remains to be seen. My speculation is that this is the former, that is. It shows that Kim Jong-un is bold enough, comfortable enough, to do something drastic like this. And in that context, I think it makes sense that Kim Jong-un would have carried out the execution of his uncle soon after the indictment, soon after the arrest. There are, of course, at least two objectives, purposes to a purge. The first, obviously, is to remove that potential rival from power. The secondary objective is, the second objective is to have a demonstrative effect, to make a case, to show you, to deter all who would harbor illusions about building power, a power base, or perhaps one day becoming a contender for the throne. It's to instill fear in those people. And this dramatic execution achieves just that. So in the short term, I don't see another number two man arising within the North Korean political system. In the long term, however, I see Kim Jong-un, it's hard for me to imagine Kim Jong-un having a long and healthy life. He could conceivably be in power for the next 50 years. He's only about 30 years old. But it's hard for me to imagine Kim Jong-un upon voluntary retirement or due to infirmed health and so forth, 50 years from now, joining his grandfather and father in the Kumsu Mausoleum, the world's most extravagant mausoleum. Because of the growing disparity in income, by all indices of measuring state power, economic power, soft power, population, territorial size, and so forth, South Korea is the preferred Korean state, the Korean state of choice for many North Koreans. And the disparity between the South and North is poised to grow with time. And that is an overwhelming existential challenge for the Kim dynasty. So I don't see Kim Jong-un being in power for the next 50 years, and I think the odds are that one day, yes, he will be deposed, but not in the foreseeable future.
Scott Snyder.
Well, I can neither refute or add to anything that my previous speakers have already said, because as with many things North Korea, there's an inverse relationship between speculation and the amount of facts that we have on which to speculate. What I would say that stands out to me is simply that this, I think, was an expected next phase in the consolidation of Kim Jong-un's power. But I think that it was done in a manner that may well weaken the system, because you know, this sort of public display of division that goes up to the top, the purges of side branches, and with Chiang Song-taek, a network that apparently had roots, may have impact in terms of the structure of the system that we haven't really anticipated yet. And then the second theme I just want to pick up that has already been discussed is, yes, Chiang Song-taek has widely been viewed as a reformer, but I thought it was very interesting in the KCNA statement that he was really presented as an obstacle to reform. That's intriguing. We'll have to wait and see what happens, but I think that that is a space to watch.
Thank you, Scott. Professor Shen Dong-li.
I have three points to make. First, this issue has come as a surprise to many, Chinese being no exception. But we view this is an internal affairs. Therefore, we are not going to give much comments on it. I give my personal, as Ralph stated, speculative work. Point two. In my view, North Korea seems to be highly unstable. This incident could lead to greater stability, no challenge for the foreseeable future to Kim Jong-un. Or this could indicate the start of more challenges. Because according to a statement of North Korean government, which justify why Jongsong-taek needs to be purged, one argument was he was preparing for replace the current leadership, hoping that on some occasion when situation would further deteriorate, he would stage a coup. Number two person is thinking about, is expecting his country situation to continue to deteriorate. Number three, number four, number five, all could expect the same, because this is reality. And none of them is satisfied with this kind of continuing poverty, famine. And they want to change, working with the boss to improve, or work together to oppose to the boss. They're unsatisfactory with the status quo. They want to improve either through reform or through self-reliance. So with the purge of Jongsong-taek, I think other people would still think about how to improve. And they may not exclude the way Jongsong-taek has been employed to think about either to do it positively or to do it negatively. For instance, when Mao Zedong has led China to the extreme poverty, Deng Xiaoping has only one way to save China. That is to purge Mao Zedong's wife, to redirect China through such kind of a virtual coup. For goodness, and we did not blame Deng Xiaoping. So as I think Jongsong-taek's wisdom may make sense that they have to change for better. But before he attained his wisdom, he has been purged. But I think others would have developed a similar wisdom to change through either legitimacy or given the condition available to whatever they can. Simply would not know who, when, under which particular circumstance. Third point is, China was indirectly deluded in their government statement why Jongsong-taek needs to be purged. Because one of the charge against him was he sold national interest to foreign country by agreeing to lease a part of the land in Lozong, a special city, for 50 years to a foreign country. And we know that to which country. So either China was naively accepting the selling of North Korean interest without intention to hurt their country, or China accepted the selling of interest in a shrewd way to hurt them. In the former way, China has been too innocent, but China still should be responsible. For the second way, China is a confidant of Jongsong-taek, should be condemned, and the wrong way to attain their legitimate national interest has to be returned, and China should apologize. Neither way is a nice way to describe China-North Korean relationship. So my foreign ministry spokesperson yesterday, actually a few hours ago, delivered remarks saying China-North Korea has developed normal economic and trade relationship. Pay attention to the word normal, not abnormal. Neither China sells our interest to them, nor we accept their illegal, unwarranted selling of their interest to us. It's a balanced exchange. Good for common interest of the two countries and the two people. This is our official soft way to deny their rampant, so indirect attack of China. Thank you very much.
Dean Shen of Fudan University, thank you. This concludes the rapid reaction portion of this morning in terms of the response to the reported execution of Zhang Songtek.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.